Another Prius.
Like a plague.
More than 10 years ago, Bill and his wife were moving to Texas. They were trying to figure out what neighborhood to live in. And so they did some driving, a little like this.
We drove around and drove around and drove around and just found these places that where we thought, okay, this is right. You know, the trees were big and the houses were older and they had front porches and it was near the center of the city. And so it just seemed right, and that's where we bought.
Fairly straightforward decision-making process, right? You choose a place that feels right. Well, just a bit after Bill and his family moved in, the 2000 presidential election happened.
Al Gore lost in Texas as a whole, but in our precinct, he won, you know, 65, 70, 75% of the vote. I mean, you could see with the signs. The signs all over our neighborhood were Democratic Party signs. I think there was one poor person who had a Republican sign, but it got torn up.
Maybe you could already tell from all the Priuses, but Bill had chosen a neighborhood that was solidly Democratic in a red state. Not by intending to, just by picking where it felt right. Unlike a lot of people, Bill's in a line of work to seize on noticing something like that. He's a newspaper reporter, and working with a local statistician, he discovered he was part of a trend that was taking place in the U.S.
What we found beginning in the mid-1970s is that people were separating by ways of life and congregating by ways of life, and those ways of life related then to politics. That it wasn't class, it wasn't family, it was your particular lifestyle choices and the identity that you were constructing for yourself.
Bill called it the Big Sort, and he wrote a fascinating book about it. Now, the Big Sort constitutes a real shift from how we used to pick where to live. The U.S. has been a country shaped by migration, from the Great Migration of African Americans leaving the South to the movement West during the Dust Bowl days. But what Bill found was that as the United States grew more prosperous, people began moving based more on lifestyle than economics. Do you care about good public transportation, a vibrant city life, lots of bookstores? Then you might choose a place like Portland, Oregon. Don't really care about those things but want a strong church community? You might choose a place like Jacksonville, Florida.
And all those things are about identity, but they're also about politics. What we found was that people were increasingly congregating with people who believe the same things that they did.
So, what does that mean? When you're surrounded by people who view the world just like you, I mean, it sounds like paradise, like a utopia. I mean, if every one of my neighbors and all of your neighbors listened to NPR, I would never have to worry about funding. This is an idea I could get into. Or maybe not. This hour, we'll be telling stories from places across the country that have experienced the great sorting of America and see how that's worked out for them and what it means for the country as a whole. First up, we're going to a place that has a reputation for being one of the most Republican parts of the country. You might think that makes for a lot of political consensus, right? Well, as So True producer Tina Antolini found out, not necessarily. Especially when it came to one local school board race.
So usually school board elections are not that big a deal, right? They're nonpartisan because what do big party politics have to do with local school decisions? Where I am today, the answer is the whole lot.
So I'm standing on the edge of the lake that's nestled right up against the downtown of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and it is very windy. And I'm standing next to a bronze statue of a moose. Hello, Idaho.
The first thing you should know about this part of Idaho, other than it's gorgeous and filled with tall, slender pine trees, is that it wasn't always a Republican stronghold.
When I first became involved in politics, I'd say that in the early 80s, mid-80s, the split between Republicans, Democrats, and Independents was almost equal across the state of Idaho. 33-33-33.
Sandy Pitano first moved to this part of Idaho, Kootenai County, to work in the industry that gave the region its labor democratic base. Mining. Silver mining, specifically. But in the early 1980s, the price of silver dropped, and the mines started to close. Then Idaho became a right-to-work state, which means the unions were pretty much dismantled here. The political tides began to shift. Sandy started working for a local Republican congressman just as a whole wave of newcomers started showing up.
People moving here from Washington State, from California, that came with much more conservative viewpoints and values.
The Coeur d'Alene Press reported in 1990 that a family from Orange County, California, had convinced a big part of its neighborhood to move to Idaho. The High Country News has reported that whole evangelical churches came north together.
And for some, they viewed this area as new ground, new fertile ground for them to engage in a particular cause.
North Idaho turned solidly Republican. One of the newcomers in Idaho was a guy named Jeff Ward. He grew up in Spokane, Washington, just across the border, and has golden memories of coming to a cabin on an Idaho lake as a child. But as an adult, Jeff got involved in politics, working as a congressional aide for Washington Congressman George Nethercutt.
Having been involved in seeing Washington State change so dramatically the time I was there to a state that didn't really represent my political viewpoints.
Jeff and his wife moved to a suburban neighborhood in Post Falls, right next to Coeur d'Alene, with a view of the mountains. He was working in publishing and didn't get involved politically right away. In fact, it took a new friend to prompt that.
My wife was, she always says that Election Day is my Super Bowl, and I sit in front of the TV and cheer and gripe and yell, and she goes, you should really get more involved. And my daughter had a birthday party here, and one of the parents that brought his daughter here was a guy named Ron Lahr. He started talking about politics.
Once they got started talking, they didn't stop. They decided to form a group together called the Reagan Republicans. But what do you focus on as a political group when your party already dominates the political landscape? The nonpartisan races, like for city council, school board. Jeff started thinking, why should these races be nonpartisan?
A huge number of voters use partisan listings as an electoral shorthand. We thought we would get involved and inform people, you know, where do people stand, by making endorsements in political races. So, you know, if somebody goes, I always vote for conservatives or Republicans, I need to know who those people are in those races.
So, here we are back at the school board elections I mentioned at the beginning of the story. The Reagan Republicans started working on local races, including one for school board in 2011. This is where we meet a guy named Tom Hamilton.
I think I joked with you when you first called it, oh, right, NPR's calling to get the token right-wing Christian nut job, right? Because that's certainly how I've been pigeonholed. But I bristle at being categorized that way.
Tom is no nut job. He's the kind of guy who will start a phone call joking that way, but follow it up with a heart-to-heart about the downside of labeling a person before you get to know them. I meet Tom in the mining equipment factory he manages on a quiet Sunday afternoon. He's come straight from teaching Sunday school at his church, and he leads me up to his office, marked by a handmade sign on the door that says, World's Best Dad.
Office decorated by Liz and Grace, and I don't have any for my oldest Sammy. She's 20 now, but that's all Lizzie and Gracie, so, yeah, my little supermodels. I keep the, it's a good thing that I am right-wing, because I've got plenty of shotguns to keep the boys in line.
Being a parent is one of the defining parts of Tom's life, and it's what led him to the moment that prompted him to run for school board.
We had a teacher who told our daughter that if your parents take you to church, they're teaching you to believe in ghosts and fairy tales. And when I went in to talk to the teacher about that, the response I got was, well, we teach kids to question their values, even those that were instilled by their parents. And my response was, not in fourth grade.
Tom's daughter went to a school that was part of the Primary Years Program, or PYP, a curriculum that is like the elementary equivalent of the International Baccalaureate. Tom was skeptical of the program's approach to critical thinking. He thought, that shouldn't amount to telling a kid that the values their parent teaches them aren't true.
And I went to a school board meeting, just to kind of observe, and I watched the board chair tell a parent, sit down, shut up, we're done listening to you. And that was literally the moment I made the decision to run for school board, knowing I could do better than that. Coupled with a realization that my views were not only not represented on the current school board, but they weren't welcomed.
Tom announced his candidacy at a meeting of the Reagan Republicans, and Jeff Ward offered to run his campaign for free.
And it was real great perspective for me, because you'd go to the school board meetings and you'd think you were the Lone Ranger, that you were the only guy that felt the way you felt about the school district, and then you'd start knocking on doors and you'd figure out, no, there's hundreds of people that feel the same way that you do, but they've never known how they could make their voice be heard.
In May of 2011, Tom won the election,
along with another Reagan Republican candidate. Within the next year and a half, the three remaining incumbent members of the school board all resigned. Conservatives were appointed to replace them. Tom and his colleagues decided to take up the issue that had motivated him to run in the first place, the Primary Years Program and its high school counterpart, the International Baccalaureate.
Welcome to the Coeur d'Alene School District 271 board meeting for August 6th of 2012. Would the gentlemen please remove their hats, and everyone please stand and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge allegiance to the flag.
The prospect of eliminating the IB and PYP programs rallied teachers and students to defend it. By the time the IB program came to a board vote in August of 2012, the issue had become a hot topic in Coeur d'Alene.
I've taught AP. I've taught IB. And this program is an exceptional educational system.
Asking the student to think and analyze and challenge the world around them is not dangerous, nor is it brainwashing.
It's a program that attempts to inject into every conversation concepts that are politically charged, such as social justice, sustainability.
What we need is to offer true freedom of choice, not freedom from choice. Please don't take our choices away simply because you don't like the Primary Years Program.
School board members pointed to dropping enrollment and a lower number of students getting college credit for courses in the IB program than the Advanced Placement program, another college prep track. They said that, combined with the expense of the IB, was enough to warrant getting rid of it.
For this reason, I ask the board for a motion directing the superintendent to terminate the IB program within CDA 271.
And so, in a unanimous vote, the board eliminated the International Baccalaureate program in Coeur d'Alene.
With that, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries.
Depending on who you ask, this was either a triumph or a tragedy. Did the elimination of Coeur d'Alene's IB program mark a conservative victory in North Idaho, or did it actually just reveal how complex a red state is below the surface? More ahead on State of the Union.
On the next Fresh Air, novelist and satirist Gary Steingart. He was a wheezing, asthmatic boy of seven when his family emigrated from the Soviet Union to Queens, New York in 1979 after Jews were allowed to leave. He writes about his coming of age in his funny but emotional memoir, Little Failure, which is now out in paperback. Join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 and again at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Friends of WILL and from Urbana's Market at the Square, happening every Saturday morning, rain or shine, from 7 a.m. to noon at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets in historic downtown Urbana. Learn more at urbanaillinois.us/market.
You're listening to State of the Reunion. I'm Al Letson, and where we left off, the Conservative School Board of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, had just gotten rid of the International Baccalaureate program. That came after a push from a group called the Reagan Republicans to make nonpartisan elections in North Idaho more partisan. So True's Tina Antolini picks up the story.
Viewed through a certain lens, this seemed like the crowning achievement of the conservative push for a presence on the school board in Coeur d'Alene. It now had a tangible impact on the ground in what kids were being taught in schools. The board also supported a $33 million school bond that would raise taxes, something one might not expect from a board dominated by conservatives. But it was the debate over the IB program that didn't sit well with some members of the community.
You know, to run a school district, you don't need to be a Republican to make good decisions for the kids or a Democrat.
Eden Ergens moved to North Idaho about 11 years ago from California in search of small-town life. For her, the elimination of the IB program was a wake-up call about how partisan things were getting.
I mean, you just need to be a person with the right idea about education and some knowledge and business savvy and all that.
So for the next round of elections, Eden got a group of people together to try to draw the partisanship back out of the school board. They formed a PAC called Balance North Idaho that included both Republicans and Democrats. So now you had the Reagan Republicans facing off against Balance North Idaho in supporting candidates. The funny thing about that? Sometimes both sides were claiming their conservative credentials.
By way of example, here's one race, Krista Hazel versus Brent Regan.
My name is Krista Hazel, and I'm a resident of Coeur d'Alene.
I met Krista in her father's downtown office, which was somewhat unusually decorated.
He is a 28-year veteran with the FBI, and he retired here. And my dad's always been a hunter, so...
That's why we have a crocodile over your head.
Exactly.
In addition to the taxidermy collection, there's also a framed picture of Krista with Sarah Palin on the mantelpiece. And yet, when Krista declared her candidacy for the school board, she was called out as not being Republican enough.
Sometimes I would say I'm running for school board, and somebody would say, "What's your stance on guns? Do you own a gun? Are you a member of the NRA?
Krista was backed by Balance North Idaho. Her opponent, Brent Regan, lives in the hills on the outskirts of Coeur d'Alene. His business, Regan Designs, invents and engineers all sorts of things, from medical devices to drives for underwater vehicles. He even has a plane he built himself.
That was a kit, but that's a four-passenger pressurized 300-mile-an-hour airplane.
Wow. So you built it, and I'm guessing you fly it, too.
Yes. Yeah, I built it, and I use it for business and fun.
By the time of the race against Krista Hazel, Brent had already been serving on the school board for a while. He was appointed to fill a vacancy left by one of the school board members who'd resigned. Brent's kids didn't go to this school district. They were homeschooled. But he didn't see that as a barrier to being effective.
The problems are generic, I think. It's not any one particular school. The problems are more systemic than they are specific.
So how did you take all of that thinking on the sort of systemic scale and apply it to the situation that you had at hand as a trustee of the school board?
Well, I mean, the school district is a large thing with a lot of inertia and a lot of moving parts. And so the idea there was what you want to do is to try some things that are new and interesting, right? And to try them on a test basis.
Brent's given speeches at Tea Party rallies, and he was endorsed by the Reagan Republicans and pronounced his party on his campaign signage. He says if he was being criticized for being too right-wing, his opponents can't claim to be nonpartisan.
Right? I mean, in order to be nonpartisan, you have to say it doesn't matter.
The race between Brent and Krista was closely watched as a kind of ideological weather vane for the area as a whole. Would the most conservative candidates confirm their hold? Or would the less conservative candidates win?
I was shocked by the numbers I received. We had people engaged in my race that had never been engaged in any race before.
All three of Balance North Idaho's candidates for school board won by a landslide.
I think what was most astonishing about the whole thing was that the realization that our community really was in the middle.
That's Dave Eubanks, who was another Balance North Idaho candidate elected to the school board that day. Dave was a public school teacher for 43 years, who actually retired early so he could run for the board. He says he's an independent, but he did his best to keep politics out of the race, unlike his opponent, who flaunted it.
Their campaign signs and literature all proclaim their devout Republicanism. And even though this is essentially a Republican community, I think a lot of people had the sense that, you know, this is really not appropriate. This is about our kids.
The city elections in the fall of 2013 followed the same pattern. More moderate candidates winning seats on the city council and the mayor's race. Maybe the most surprising outcome of the school board election, though, was the dynamics it created on the new board. When Dave Eubanks was running for election, he said he wanted the board to find consensus, to learn how to agree with one another. Tom Hamilton, remember him, the conservative member of the school board who voted for eliminating the IB program? He didn't think consensus was possible.
And I remember kind of muttering under my breath, you know, BS, he doesn't really mean that during the election. It's been shocking. He means that. He means that to his core. He means that. And the guy that I probably thought I'd enjoy working with the least is becoming a friend. You know, I actually really like the guy.
We're all in this together. And the more perspectives you have, the more brains you can pick. If you're all just coming from it from the one viewpoint, you're going to miss a lot.
Although politically, I think there'd be very few things that we would agree on. When it comes to the decisions that we make for kids, he and I may start far apart, but we found a great means of being able to find the middle.
Maybe there's some model in that for a country that sometimes feels irrevocably divided. Having one party dominate here in Kootenai County hasn't diminished the political wrangling. It seems to have exaggerated it. And that means that in the end, the real battle was how to relate to one another and keep politics out of it.
So not all these migrations are based on political beliefs. SoChu producer Delaney Hall found a community in the Southwest where people have come together for a completely different reason.
I'm just going to fill up this tub of water.
The day before I leave on a reporting trip, I usually just pack my suitcase and test my recording equipment to make sure everything is working right.
Okay, that should probably be enough.
But tomorrow I'm headed to an isolated community in eastern Arizona, and I've been asked to clean my clothes in a very particular way.
I have a box of baking soda, just dumping some of it in this tub of water.
I'm going to be interviewing people who have a condition called multiple chemical sensitivity. It means that they're seriously intolerant to laundry detergent, perfume, cigarette smoke, any number of the synthetic chemicals floating through our air.
Add just a little bit more.
Letting an outsider into their neighborhood means the threat of exposure. So I've been showering with Dr. Bronner's unscented soap for 2 weeks. And now this.
I got an old pair of jeans. I'm putting them in too. And I have definitely never had to prepare for a reporting trip in this way.
Multiple chemical sensitivity, which is also sometimes known as environmental illness, is a controversial condition. People who have it are powerfully affected, sometimes disabled, by migraines, muscle pain, rashes, nausea, and fatigue. But many studies have failed to show a convincing connection between chemical exposures and symptoms. There's no clear medical consensus about what causes the illness. Doctors disagree about whether symptoms are physiological, psychological, or both.
It's my first morning in Snowflake. And this is really an incredible landscape. Very flat, very dry. You can see a long way in every direction, and the sky is very blue.
I'm not here to find out whether or not multiple chemical sensitivity is quote-unquote real. I'm here to learn more about what this community is like, and how people cope after leaving behind homes, jobs, and sometimes families to escape to this remote, grassy plateau. This is an illness that can leave people very isolated.
Hi.
I hope you're Delaney.
I am. Yeah.
Susan Malloy has short, curly hair and a wide grin.
That's all right.
People have described her to me as a fairy godmother and the queen. It's below freezing, but all the windows in her small house are open. For people with MCS, their home is the only environment they can truly control. I'm suddenly very aware of my smell. I'm worried I didn't prepare well enough. Susan offers me a cup of coffee.
Do you like milk in it?
Sure.
And then, just as I worried...
I smell cigarettes.
What would you like me to do?
I'm not quite sure.
Okay.
I'm going to get close to you for just a sec, okay?
Sure.
The blouse, maybe.
Okay.
Do you mind if I give you something else to wear?
No, not at all.
Okay. Well, I do have guest clothes.
Okay.
Susan is at the heart of this community. She works with curious outsiders like me, attends conferences on disability rights, and spends hours each week answering phone calls and email from people who are ill. She's healthier than many of her neighbors, but that hasn't always been the case.
For me, it was just real fast. I felt this just bizarre feeling in my head and my sinuses and the palate of my mouth and my throat also all closed.
Susan was living in San Francisco when she first got sick, back in the early 90s. Her sensitivities began to cascade, which is pretty typical for the illness. Her allergy to chemicals grew into a sensitivity to food and clothing, then electricity. Telephones, computers, kitchen appliances, pretty much everything became toxic to her.
Furniture had to go. The rugs had to go. I had two girlfriends come over and take my clothes. Just got rid of almost everything right away.
Susan slept on friends' porches, in her car, and at her parents'. At her very worst, she couldn't even drink chemically treated tap water, and her mom put buckets in the yard to gather rain. Then a friend told her about Snowflake, a rural, high-altitude community with good, clean air. When she came to visit...
For me, the improvement was so radical. You know, you get out of the car, you feel better. You can walk. You don't need the oxygen tank. Your speech is clear. I didn't exactly want to move here, but my body said, yeah, we're moving here.
For Susan, the move felt like a passage, like a journey between two different worlds.
Like in the old days for someone to get on a ship and go to the United States from Ireland. They didn't really want to leave, it's just they weren't able to make it anymore, and so they took this huge risk and got on a ship. I think it felt a little bit like that to me.
And gradually more people moved to Snowflake. They came from all over. An engineer from Denmark, a marketing director from Toronto, a chef from the Philippines, a teacher from San Francisco. There are now about three dozen households scattered across the area, all united by this illness. And they keep coming. When Susan's phone rings, it's usually not a good sign.
I don't get calls from people for whom everything is going great, you know? Hello?
Hi, Susan. This is Joan Robinson. How are you?
Hi.
Do you know if Carol's Place is available? Because I could not be doing worse. And I've got to get out of here. My skin is literally burning and bleeding from the pollution.
Susan gets several calls like this a week. From runners, people who are moving from place to place, trying to find somewhere that feels safe.
My body went nuts.
I'm sorry, but there is someone living there.
Susan keeps track of the limited housing in Snowflake, and she breaks the bad news when there's no help she can really give.
You never know. I'm waiting for a miracle to happen. I need a miracle, Susie. This is just incredible.
I don't have any miracles. I wish I did. I know.
I need to go. Even, I know you're not asking me to get off, but I need to go because I'm too emotional right now.
I'm afraid that's what a typical call is like. You know, people who are real sick where they are and need to be in another kind of housing, and there isn't any. Well, we're on our way to visit my new next-door neighbors, people, two women who are building a house that's absolutely lovely.
Millie Sundberg and Charlie Lugo moved to Snowflake 3 years ago. Housing is very limited here, so they've decided to build their own chemically safe home based on techniques that have been developed in Snowflake over the years.
Is it okay to come in?
Yeah.
Okay.
This house represents a huge leap for Millie and Charlie. A few years ago, they were sleeping in their car while they looked for a doctor in Orange County to treat Millie's debilitating sensitivities. One morning, Charlie was brushing her teeth in a parking lot.
And then somebody gave me a banana. You know, I turned to her and said, what does she think? We're homeless? You know, it's a hard thing to accept because we had such a great life.
Charlie had worked as a chef and Millie had worked in the tech industry. She made a good salary and traveled all over for conferences.
I was connected to an enormous community of people, and I got sick one day and I fell out of the community, and basically, people never heard from me ever again. I couldn't go back online, I couldn't communicate with people, I couldn't phone people. I've been out in the desert, secluded in a box without any electricity for 3 years.
But slowly, they've been making a life again in Snowflake, with Susan's help.
She's lived it and she's listened to it. You know, we're one in a long story and a long history of people that have come through Snowflake, and some make it and some don't. It is what it is.
Susan has been standing nearby, listening. She hugs Millie.
Thanks, Sus.
It's true that there's been a long line of people to come through Snowflake in the past 20 years, But the history of medical migration to this part of the country goes back even farther than that. 100 years ago, doctors encouraged people with tuberculosis to head west for the clean, dry air. So many patients ended up here in Arizona that tent cities sprouted up across the state, and locals gave them a nickname, lungers, because of the hacking cough that characterized the illness.
If you're sick, you're dangerous, and you're not as welcome as you were before, and you get, in effect, put on the ice floe. People did that with typhoid fever, with polio. So this is not an uncommon experience for human beings. It's just right now it's our turn. We're it. We're the new guys.
But the complicated thing about this illness is that it's so unknown. Some doctors would argue that this place isolates people, pushes them deeper into their sickness. But Susan, Millie, and Charlie told me this place saved their lives.
All it takes is one family building a gas station out there on the road, and a lot of us that have to move.
We're back on Susan's porch, and she's looking out over the landscape. In a little while, she has a date with another friend in the community. She's going to read him a book, which means she'll stand outside his house, hold the book up to his window, and turn the pages for him. He's too sensitive to let her, or even the book itself, into the house. It makes life here in Snowflake seem so precarious.
It is fragile, and I know it, and I treasure it for being here at all. So I am hypervigilant about always hoping that nothing's going to happen to us. You know, always hoping that we're going to keep getting away with this life that we've built here.
Next on State of the Reunion, a community of spiritual seekers in rural Iowa. That's right, Iowa. And a lesbian mecca in the Northeast. Stay with us. Support for State of the Reunion comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, a growing network of listeners, producers, and stations collaborating to make public radio more public. PRX.org.
We've taken to calling our Saturday afternoon schedule on WILL AM the smartest in radio. But we should probably stop limiting ourselves to just Saturday afternoons and brag about the entire schedule, because with shows like Morning Edition, Fresh Air, Science Friday, Says You, and so many more, we bring you thoughtful programs that enrich your world each and every day. And starting on October 18th, during our fall fundraising campaign, we'll be asking you to support intelligent radio for all of Central Illinois. So tune in and make the smart choice.
WILL programming is made possible by Sinfonia DeCamera, presenting a Richard Strauss celebration on Friday, October 17th at 7:30 p.m. in the Follinger Great Hall at Krannert. Bernard Scully and John Dee join Ian Hobson and Sinfonia as they celebrate the 150th anniversary of Richard Strauss's birth.
You're listening to State of the Reunion. I'm Al Letson, and today we are exploring communities of migration, places where people have settled for a very particular reason, whether it's political, medical, or spiritual. For instance, when I say Fairfield, Iowa, I imagine the first phrase that comes to your mind is not transcendental meditation, right?
Well, I learned to meditate back in college in 1971. It's basically just a mental technique that allows the mind to settle down to a deep level. People call it a state of restful alertness, where the mind and body are settled down, but the mind is alert, not asleep.
Well, meet Francis Tickey. He runs Radiance Dairy in Fairfield, a place that blends the old agricultural traditions of the heartland with the new culture of spiritual seekers.
Well, the milk machine is pretty gentle. It's kind of like a calf sucking. It turns on and off and on and off. There have been studies done over years showing that when you play a soothing classical music for cows, they're settled down and quiet. And when you play hard rock, it kind of riles them up a little bit. So it makes sense that playing a soothing music to cows would be a good thing. So this milking parlor is called a double eight parlor, and that means that eight cows come on each side, and we stand down in the pit in between them. So when we milk the cows,
the music we play in the barn is actually broadcast from
the university here. And what they do is they play, it's classical Indian music, it's ragas. And apparently there's a raga for every hour of the day. So the station broadcasts the ragas that are supposedly in tune with enlivening the energies of that part of the day. So it's time to put the milking machine on. Well, Fairfield, Iowa is somewhat unique, and partly because about 40 years ago, the Transcendental Meditation Organization bought a university here, and it drew people from all over the country and even from other countries to come and be in this area. Way back 40 years ago, I think that the local people were a little concerned that maybe they are losing their community, and that there was, at first, I think, maybe two cultures. But over time, those cultures have been pretty much integrated, and so you don't really see that anymore in Fairfield, I don't think. You can hear, as the milk goes by, that little weep, the little air hole. So you can hear that the milk kind of flowing a little bit there. It made a unique population base here in Fairfield, and there was a lot of interest in that demographics, in healthy lifestyles, healthy foods, and so I don't know of anywhere else in the country where you can have the milk from 80 organic cows all be sold in a town of 10,000.
So some of the milk that's coming out here, out of the cow right now, will be on the shelf in about 2 hours.
I think meditation probably has helped develop my intuition, and that is something I can apply to my farming. I think it's helped me to be able to listen to the land even, to know what's going to work best on the land. Because it's not just strict engineering out there trying to design a farming system on the landscape.
Imagine you grew up on a farm like Francis Tickey's, but felt like you didn't totally belong. There was something about you that marked you as different, something that you were afraid to share with others. Then imagine you heard about a town that was a haven for people like you. So true producer Tina Antolini has more.
Lisa Shulka loved the farm she grew up on. 800 acres, 40 head of dairy cows.
I grew up in Wisconsin, a very small town of like 3,000. I think I realized I was gay when I was like 15 or 16, and it was kind of like keep dating boys, keep moving forward and doing what you're supposed to do. And then I fell in love with a girl in Wisconsin, yeah, in this small town, and we really, it was kind of scary because you had to hide it.
Even moving to a slightly bigger town in Wisconsin, Lisa and her girlfriend felt unsafe. Her best lesbian friend would wear a fake wedding ring to work, pretending she was straight to avoid trouble. Then one night, after years of living this way, Lisa was watching TV and saw mention of a story coming up.
Good evening, I'm Hugh Downs.
And I'm Barbara Walters, and this is 2020.
It was a story about a town called Northampton, Massachusetts, that was full of lesbians. As you can maybe tell from the sound of this story, this was a while ago, 1991. The very concept of lesbianism was a bit of a shocker.
Tonight, a controversial lifestyle, a rare and intimate portrait of a lesbian community.
I remember seeing the previews for it, and we were just like, oh, we have to see this. This is amazing. What kind of awesome town is this? You know?
One of every seven women in this town is a lesbian, and not everyone likes it.
I find that lesbians and gay people are not normal.
Whatever your opinion is, don't make up your mind until you see Lynn Scherr's report. Women Who Love Women.
And immediately I'm like, I want to live there. And my girlfriend and I at the time, I don't know what it was, because we were looking for a safe place. You know, and we didn't really want to live in a big city, so it just seemed ideal.
This was an enormous big deal, having this on TV. The entire LGBT community in town was waiting for this to be broadcast, and we all turned out to all watch it together, like you would a presidential election or a moon landing. I mean, it was huge. It was a huge big deal.
Michael Cusick was a young gay man living in Northampton when the 2020 story aired. He says immediately after they showed a shot of a popular bar called the North Star, the phone there started ringing.
Women all over the United States were calling the North Star. and calling and calling, and the phone rang off the hook for days of women trying to figure out how to get to Northampton, and what could they do for a living in Northampton, and where could they live, and was it like it was on TV?
For lesbians around the country, the 2020 story read like an infomercial for a place where you could be yourself out in public. For people in town, it was like a proclamation of presence. Lesbians exist. But how the heck did a small New England town get to be such a destination for lesbians in the first place?
Most of the lesbians that formed all this weren't born in Northampton. They came in from big cities or small cities to move here. So there was this migration.
Bette Power moved to Northampton in 1979, following lesbian friends from Chicago.
They came out here because they were lesbian separatists, and they wanted to build a lesbian separatist community. They were part of that underground.
Bette, who identifies as a transgender man now, but was a lesbian back then, he runs the Sexual Minorities Archives here. He says the lesbian separatists of the 70s chose Northampton for good reasons. It has a long history of being a progressive place. Sojourner Truth lived in the area. The Underground Railroad ran through here. Back in the early 20th century, a woman named Anna DeNacase and her female romantic partner started a tea room here called Ye Rose Tree Inn. It was very popular with students at Smith, a women's college in town.
Anna DeNacase was clearly queer. She was visually queer, meaning that she dressed in men's attire. We have quotes from Smith students. One quote is, "Everybody is in love with Madame. We don't know if it's a man or a woman."
When dancing was added to the tea room's offerings, meaning potentially girls dancing with girls, Smith put the kibosh on going to the Rose Tree Inn, and the place closed. But it established Northampton as a town where a woman could come and start her own business.
And that's the mentality that lesbians had right after the Stonewall Rebellion.
That was the riot in New York City that's seen as the start of the gay rights movement.
They said, the men are going to dominate this gay movement. Oh, it's not working for us. We're going to build our own world. We're going to build our own society. We're going to make Northampton ours.
At the time, this town, which is about 2 hours west of Boston, it was pretty down and out. There were a lot of empty storefronts, which means they were cheaply available to women who had business ideas, from bookstores to a lesbian-only auto repair shop to karate.
The dojo, which was called the Nutcracker Suite at the beginning, and then became Valley Women's Martial Arts.
In the 1980s, that underground lesbian society went public. The devastation of the AIDS epidemic led the lesbians here to align with the gay community for the first pride marches. The reception in town was mixed. There were death threats left on the archives' phone machines. Pride marches needed police protection.
In 1983, we had young heterosexual males standing on the bridge on Main Street and throwing things down at the marchers as we passed underneath and yelling, "Oh, let's go, let's get them, let's get the faggots." And police had to remove them.
Northampton had been a mostly working-class mill town. Long-standing residents were watching as the place changed around them.
It was becoming women-driven, a lesbian town. It was becoming something they didn't recognize. And lesbians did seem to have power here. It was restaurants and businesses, and it's like, okay, what's happening?
By the 1990s, when the 2020 story came out, Northampton had started to embrace its new identity. The National Enquirer ran a story proclaiming it Lesbianville, USA. In the late 90s, the town elected its first out lesbian mayor.
Well, I always say when people would come to visit here, like, that we've won the battle.
Here's Michael Cusick again. At this point, he's like the unofficial mayor in Northampton. Everyone knows Michael. We watched the old 2020 story together, and it's so dated now that he literally couldn't keep from cracking up laughing every few seconds.
Butch, I learned, tends to look like this. Short hair. Short hair in my dress. As opposed to femme.
This needs to be on the web.
Some of the lesbians insisted.
Personally, like, I was standing there when this was really incredible and, like, incredibly positive, and we all got behind it. And now here I am 20 years later watching it being like, really? Like, wow, really? Like, we were excited about this? So it makes me really think how far we've come in 20 years.
Gay marriage has been legal in Massachusetts since 2004. In Northampton, same-sex couples are such a part of the social fabric here that nobody thinks twice about it anymore. There are actually some signs being lesbian is more normal here than being straight.
On Facebook, too, straight friends of mine had their child say, are you and dad lesbians? Because they were so used to the idea that, like, parents would be lesbians.
In fact, it's gotten to be so normal here that there are fewer and fewer lesbian organizations.
Yeah, like the bookstore, the gay bookstore is gone, and, you know, there's, like, one gay club.
That's Lisa Shulka again, the one who moved to this area after seeing the 2020 story on TV. Pride and Joy, the last gay bookstore in town, closed in 2013.
There's really not any defining markers in town anymore that says that this is really an open place for gay people. And that's part of the case because you can go anywhere in town and it's completely queer friendly and you probably have someone gay serving you and it's just open everywhere.
Which is progress, right? But for some in Northampton, it feels like a mixed victory.
I mean, I would say that I don't think we have a lesbian community anymore.
Susan McKenna teaches at Commonwealth College at the nearby University of Massachusetts. She studied Northampton's lesbian community, but she also lives in town with her same-sex partner.
I think one of the reasons is that there became such a large population that there was no longer a need to have, like, a, quote, community, like a small group that would come together. And there's a real sense that we are like everybody else. We are just the same as everyone else.
But for some, like Bette Power, who have been here for years, there's something lost in that assimilation.
Because does assimilation equal a new invisibility? Does our culture, whether it's lesbian, gay, bi, or trans, get lost in assimilation?
And then there's the question of whether, for all the acceptance in Northampton, it's actually providing an artificial sense that all the battles have been won. Of course, not everyone wants to be an activist. Lots of people just want to live their lives as easily as possible. But Lisa Shulka worries that it can be lulling here. It's easy to forget that discrimination is still rampant elsewhere in the country and the world.
You know, I'm very comfortable in my little bubble here, but it doesn't seem like there's as much activism because, you know, we've progressed so much and it really does give you the sense of maybe false sense of security that everything's okay and everyone's treated equally. And you seem like you're fighting the good fight every day, but it's also very easy to fight the good fight here when everyone is accepting of you.
So I'm not just an objective observer to this story. I've lived in Northampton for years, ever since attending college in this area. I'm not gay, but I felt the warm embrace of this bubble. It's really comfortable to live in a place where you can pretty much count on everyone around you sharing your perspectives. But it's also mostly white here, mostly middle class. There isn't much to challenge your worldview. And I think there is a downside to that. It makes it harder for us to understand people who aren't like us.
So these stories might sound a little far-fetched, right? I mean, most of us don't want to or have to go to the extremes that some of the communities in this hour have. Or do we? Hear me out. This isn't an indictment of you, dear listener, but many of us wake up listening to NPR or some other news station. We go to the same websites, TV shows, whatever media that agrees with our worldview. We talk to people, post on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, with folks who think just like us because we're right. And if they should happen to end up in our feed, well, then we attack. Because we're right and they are wrong. But if all your concepts are approved and upheld by everyone around you, how will you ever have the contrast to learn, to grow, to know when you're wrong? It may seem like paradise to be surrounded by people who are just like you, but utopia, a utopia is a beautiful monochrome fantasy. Reality at times is ugly, but it's filled with an abundance of colors.
We're just less likely to run into people who think differently than we do. We begin to think that the norm is the people that we have around us, and we get a distorted view of what the rest of the country is all about.
We're tribal. We always have to have, you know, the other guys. We have to have the other football team that we absolutely hate.
I think it's been a way of almost dehumanizing the other, and it's my way or no way. You know, life is a lot more complex than that.
I want to live where I feel safe. I want to live where I feel comfortable. I can have a nice life. And for a lot of people, that feels better among people like themselves. It takes hard work to change that. It takes active countering and saying, no, let's interrupt this.
Someone might want everyone to agree with them all the time, but in the end, it's probably not going to get you the best results. You get results, but not the ones that serve a majority of people well.
The Sorting of America was produced by Tina Antolini and Delaney Hall, with help from senior editor Taki Telenidis. The rest of the So True staff is producer Laura Starcheski and business manager Bree Burge. Our intern crew is Gabe Graben, Nina Feldman, Catherine Whalen, Kathy Tu, Alessandra Bergerman, and Eric Jones, who produced our story on the Radiance Dairy in Iowa. Special thanks to Sierra Crane Murdoch with the High Country News and Drew Xanthopoulos, who's been working on a documentary film set partly in Snowflake for the last 2 years. To see some of his footage, photos from this episode, a video of morning milking at Radiance, and listen to more State of the Reunion episodes, just go to stateoftheunion.com. So True is distributed by PRX and NPR, with major funding provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Al Ledson. And remember,